At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a 529 plan can help meet your college savings goals. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It's 524 miles, the internet tells us, from Detroit to Washington, D.C. That means Ford CEO Alan Mulally is counting on his hybrid road trip to be worth $17 million for every single one of those miles. Ford said today it might need $9 billion in government loans. GM needs as much as 18, part of it, right now. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constellation Energy, working to provide responsible, sustainable energy to power America's future. Constellation Energy, the way energy works. And by Shriners Hospitals for Children, providing treatment for orthopedic, burn, and spinal cord injuries at no cost to the families. More at ShrinersForKids.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you with us on this Tuesday. It's the 2nd of December today. I don't know if he's actually doing the driving himself, but Ford's Alan Mulally clearly learned his lesson the last time he went to Washington. He and his colleagues, Rick Wagner of GM and Robert Nardelli at Chrysler, got a thumping when they showed up in corporate jets. So Mulally's taking to the road for hearings that start Thursday. Wagner and Nardelli probably flying commercial, we're told. They'll be bringing with them details of the bailout justifications Congress asked them for last time, broad outlines of which were released today. More green cars, smaller and smarter business plans, and executive pay cuts are the highlights. Eric Noble runs an auto industry consulting firm called The Car Lab. Eric, good to talk to you.
Likewise, Guy.
Stakes are very high for Detroit with these plans. Based on what we've seen so far, is this going to do it?
Well, I think what we've now seen from General Motors is a little bit of an admission that they need gastric bypass and to get rid of some brands, and that might be effective.
They're going to get rid of some brands. They're going to go green. Rick Wagner, the CEO, is going to work for a dollar. Ford said essentially the same thing. Is that really the best they can come up with, green and cheap CEOs?
Well, objectively, both companies need to stay in business, and that's about trimming some fat, and that means getting rid of some brands. What we need to see from Ford is that probably Mercury needs to be put out to pasture on a permanent basis. General Motors' admission now, or its tacit admission, that Saturn, Pontiac, and Saab are all officially for sale along with Hummer is welcome news.
Were you surprised at all at the immediacy of General Motors' need? They said they need $4 billion this month, or it's probably over.
You know, the burn rate at General Motors is vast. And that's just a function of their size, and it has taken for years more revenue than they can generate. So, no, it's not surprising.
CEO Rick Wagner has been at General Motors for a long time. He has been reluctant to cut brands so far. Remind us of why that is. What happened?
Well, last time Rick cut a brand, it was Oldsmobile, and that cost the company arguably over $1 billion to pay out some dealers and their lawyers. So for years... Since then, Rick has been probably overly reluctant to make some further necessary cuts, namely Pontiac, and probably today we see Saturn and Saab also joining those lists.
Do you think this will be the last bailout then, Eric?
You know, the economy is going to be the determinant there. If consumers don't get out their wallets and walk back onto dealer lots, this is probably not going to be the last bailout. We're looking at an industry that today can't make money, whether Toyota, Honda, or General Motors are on the billboard.
Well, that's a good point. This bailout's not actually going to help them sell cars, is it?
No, this bailout might restore a little bit of consumer confidence that these brands are going to be around, but everybody's got a problem, and that's low traffic.
Low traffic, not a lot of consumers.
Not a lot of shoppers.
All in all, then, Eric, is this what Congress needed to hear?
Let's hope it is. I think for the survival of General Motors, it's what the shareholders needed to hear. Whether or not they're going to have the funds to implement all of this is the question that's now going to be before Congress.
Eric Noble runs a company called the Car Lab. It consults for the auto industry. Eric, thanks a lot.
My pleasure, Kai.
After she got a look at the plans this afternoon, Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi made it pretty clear what she thinks is in the cards.
I believe that an intervention will happen, either legislatively or from the administration. I think it's pretty clear that bankruptcy is not an option.
Despite November sales that were nothing short of incredibly horrible, down 30% or more, Detroit did pretty well on Wall Street today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Speaker Pelosi brought up the TARP this afternoon when she was talking about money for Detroit. That's how the White House, this one or the next one, might find its way clear to bail out car makers if loans can't pass Congress. One thing the TARP hasn't been used for yet is mortgage relief. And we learned today the worst of the housing crisis may not be behind us. One of the big consumer credit companies came out with a disheartening bit of data that the number of delinquent mortgages is expected to nearly double by the end of next year, adjustable rate mortgages in particular. That means homeowners who aren't having any trouble paying their bills right now could get squeezed as their mortgages reset. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler has more.
Historically, the number of people 60 days late with mortgage payments has hovered around 2%.
We expect it to more than triple from historical norms.
That's Ezra Becker with the credit bureau TransUnion, which did the analysis. He expects mortgage delinquencies will be near 8% by the end of next year.
Not only is it rising, but it's rising at an increasing rate.
So what can be done? Barry Zigas with the Consumer Federation of America points to work being done by the FDIC.
It is possible to help homeowners avoid foreclosure and default by intervening quickly and energetically to adjust the mortgage payments to a level that they can afford. And we just haven't seen enough of that across the government, and that is one of the reasons we're going to see more delinquencies than we might otherwise have.
Part of the problem is the bonds that are tied to mortgage debt. Zigas says those bonds have been sliced up and sold to investors all over the world.
The government should be focusing more attention on how to move these bonds into an ownership structure where they can be dealt with, and they've been very slow to do so.
If foreclosures are allowed to increase, more bonds will go bad. Helping individual homeowners gets messy. Mark Zandi, chief economist with MoodysEconomy.com, points out the challenge of deciding who gets help.
If you start helping homeowners, then other homeowners that are just struggling to get by will raise their hand and say, well, why not help me? I deserve help as well.
If you need help, talk to your lender. Banks are much more likely to work out some deal if you contact them before you stop sending them checks. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
To find out what it's like for those consumers who are trying to get out from under mortgages they can't afford, we have called a mortgage broker. Fred Glick runs U.S. Loans Mortgages in Philadelphia. Mr. Glick, welcome to the program.
Hello there.
Who are you seeing come in to try to reset their mortgages?
Well, the people that I'm seeing are people who have really three things. Number one, income that they can document. Number two, equity in their property. And number three, decent credit.
What about the people who have, you know, 800 credit scores, but the value of whose houses have fallen so that they're, you know, either underwater or barely positive, so they don't necessarily have the capital? If they came in, what would you say?
You have to go through the appraisal process, and it's kind of silly because somebody's making a, say, $3,000 payment. They have 800 credit scores, and they're not worried about the value of their house because they're not moving now. Then why can't they just make a $2,000 payment? This happened in the old days when savings and loans used to hold the paper. You would just walk in and renegotiate the rate with them, pay them a little fee, and they would just lower the rate. But now because everything is paid through securities sold to investors, there has to be rules. And one of the rules is you have to have a current appraisal of the property.
How's business generally? Are you seeing a lot of walk-in traffic?
It's a little quieter. We do a lot of internet business, and we usually get phone calls. Most of our calls are from California. And a lot of times, you're just telling people, I'm sorry, I can't do this for you.
When you tell these folks that you can't really help them, are they surprised at that?
Some are. We can do a little quick online check as to what the value of their property is, and they go, oh, my God, I thought it was worth $600, and it's worth $450.
If we had addressed the issue of mortgages and foreclosures, I don't know, a year ago,
Do you think all those securities that are backed by these mortgages would have been worth something, and then we might not be in this mess?
Probably, but the infamous but. Most of this problem dwells from the fact that the people who were on Wall Street would sell to, say, the Norwegian pension fund $500 million worth of mortgages and tell them that these are perfect, clean loans when they weren't. And so the people who have the money to buy these mortgage-backed securities now don't believe the guys who are selling them the paper. So they have to come up with these stringent regulations that makes it more difficult to get the loans.
Fred Glick runs U.S. Loans Mortgage. He's a mortgage broker in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Mr. Glick, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you.
Through the financial mess of the past couple of months, there has been one name that has stood out as relatively healthy, which I grant you isn't saying much, but Goldman Sachs seemed to have sidestepped a lot of the problems that laid its competitors low. Notice I said seemed there, as in the past tense, because the Wall Street Journal reported today that Goldman's run of good luck may be coming to an end. From New York, Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports.
Goldman Sachs still has almost 2 weeks to go before it reports fourth quarter earnings. But Wall Street's already playing a spirited game of limbo with Goldman's estimates. How low can they go? One analyst is predicting losses of $2.3 billion, another $2.7 billion. Bert Ely is a banking consultant, and he says he wouldn't be surprised if the bank lost money this time around.
Goldman has done, relatively well compared to its competitors, but, you know, I don't think there are any banking or financial companies of any size that aren't experiencing problems in this economic downturn, particularly given how the markets have been performing.
If Goldman did lose money in the fourth quarter, it would be the first time since the bank went public in 1999. Part of Goldman's problem is figuring out how things work in a post-apocalyptic world. Among other things, it's not supposed to be making the kinds of risky bets that helped it make money in the past. Michael Wong is an analyst at Morningstar. He's a little more optimistic than some of his colleagues.
During all the previous quarters, they hedged pretty well. If they have continued to hedge well for the fourth quarter, there may actually be a slight positive surprise from the doom and gloom that everyone is predicting.
In any case, those gloomy predictions aren't helping Goldman's stock any. Just 3 months ago, it was trading at more than $160 a share. It closed today at $65. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Here's a nifty macroeconomic problem with some real-world applications. What do you do if you're running an economy and you run out of room, room on interest rates in this case? One of the textbook solutions to get things going again is to cut those rates. But Ben Bernanke has already done that, as you know, and he's done it a lot. The federal funds rate is 1% right now. And since you can't really drop that rate lower than zero, the chairman of the Fed's probably going to have to get creative. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer looks at how he might do that.
Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke says the Fed could jumpstart the economy by buying U.S. Treasury securities. As demand went up, treasuries could pay less interest. Mortgages and other loans are tied to Treasury interest rates. So, Wachovia senior economist Mark Vintner says mortgage rates would fall and stimulate refinancing.
And that would free up some cash to either rebuild savings and strengthen household balance sheets or to drive consumer spending.
Some economists say if the Fed starts buying treasuries, it'll be following in Japan's footsteps, basically using treasuries to control long-term interest rates and encourage lending. But University of Chicago finance professor Douglas Diamond says it didn't work so well for Japan in the 1990s.
Some people think the one reason it didn't work in Japan is because their banking system was in such poor shape. You know, just giving the banks incentives to lend when they're all broke didn't really work.
Diamond says U.S. banks are in better shape. But there's another problem. The U.S. will bump up against bigger players who bought treasuries and are holding them. Who are they? Give you one guess. Yep, China and Japan. Catherine Mann is a professor at Brandeis International Business School. She says the effect of buying treasuries might just be psychological.
They're using yet another arrow in the quiver to try to slay the financial crisis dragon.
The downside?
you run the risk that it doesn't work and psychology is damaged further.
But right now, that's a risk Dragon fighter Bernanke is willing to take. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Coming up, the recession comes to wealthy suburbs.
There certainly are senior citizens who are on very limited income here and are really struggling at this point.
But first, let's do the numbers. Wall Street took heart today after taking that header yesterday. The Dow Industrials bounced back with a 270-point rise, 3.3%. The blue chips finished at 8,419. The NASDAQ regained 51 points, 3.7%, ending at 1449. The S&P 500 buffed up 32 points. That is just shy of 4%, wrapped up at 848. General Electric was the biggest factor in the S&P's rise. The conglomerate promised to maintain its dividend, and that helped bring good things to GE shares. They powered up more than 13%. News that the Fed will extend some of its key lending programs lifted financial stocks today. Bank of America and Citigroup shares recovered almost 12%. Wells Fargo stock galloped more than 10% higher. Never mind that oil and gas prices slipped to new three-year lows today. Energy stocks rose anyway. ExxonMobil and Chevron shares pumped up more than 4%. Stock in ConocoPhillips spurted 3% higher. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals. 888-VANGUARD. And by Constant Contact, the email marketing service dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits succeed. ConstantContact.com. The Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk is supported by the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship. Online at kauffman.org. Want more from Marketplace's special Fallout coverage? It's all on our website. You'll find special podcasts, explainers, and videos. Go to marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Labor Department reports on third quarter productivity and costs. The Federal Reserve Board releases its latest Beige Book survey of current economic conditions, the eighth and final report for the year. And a shout out to Illinois. It became the 21st state on December 3rd, 1818. Another star was added to the flag. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Money. We use it every day. But how many of us actually think about it? It's used for payment for goods or services. It's the source of joy and angst, has been since ancient times. And the pursuit of it has gotten us into the fix we're in. Economic historian Neil Ferguson explores that idea and many, many more in his new book, The Ascent of Money. Professor, good to have you with us.
It's nice to be here, Kai.
There is an abstraction here that sort of runs through this book. As money evolves from minted metal to paper to instruments of higher finance, it eventually turns into nothingness, right? I mean, you make the point that once you get to a certain level of finance, it's just numbers in a computer somehow.
Right. I mean, most of what we call money today technically is not banknotes, much less coins. You have a little piece of plastic, I'm guessing, Kai, that tells you you can put it in a hole in the wall and take out some cash. And you sort of assume that all the money that you have in your account is there. But actually, it's not there, because the whole point of what banks do is that they take deposits and they make loans. In the big transactions that go on in financial markets when people buy and sell derivatives or whatever it is, in fact, the money is nothing more than an entry on a screen. In that sense, what we call money is an extraordinarily intangible thing, and it all depends on trust. We all have to believe the money is real. The moment that trust is gone, the moment we lose faith in the monetary system, the edifice comes tumbling down.
Well, on that point, you make the observation that there is no small amount of Darwinism in the history of money. How did this idea of survival of the fittest in the financial world get us to the crisis we're in today?
I think there was tremendous competition in financial markets. You had banks incentivized to borrow ever more money in pursuit of the highest returns on shareholder equity that they could possibly get, which meant you ended up with balance sheets 40 times the size of the capital of the bank. This was attractive to bank executives, particularly at banks like Lehman Brothers, because they were compensated to a large extent in, you've guessed it, the stock of their own bank. So they naturally wanted to see the share price kept up. And the regulators took their eye off the balance sheets. They were worrying about the wrong things, it seems to me.
One of the themes of this book is that the ascent of money really is sort of a foregone conclusion, that despite ups and downs over time, you know, money and its importance and significance and the benefits we all get from it will increase over time. I'm wondering, though, if maybe it got away from us this time.
When I talk about the ascent of money, I would compare it to a rather jagged mountain horizon. You're kind of rising up from the foothills, but periodically falling off a cliff. You never go all the way back down to the foothills, though, no matter how bad the crisis. During a crisis, it's very easy to overreact. Yes, this crisis is serious. It may well be the worst recession since the early 80s, maybe the early 70s, maybe even the 1930s. But it's not the end of the world. It's a massive financial disruption. It has all kinds of negative consequences. But the fatal thing is to turn around and say, aha, this is the fault of banks. Therefore, we should put them all under state control and abandon the free market.
Well, now, but wait a minute, because didn't money, that is to say financial institutions in this case, aren't they, to, I guess, coin a phrase here, the root of all evil in this circumstance?
This crisis has very deep roots. I talk in terms of an age of leverage, an age of debt that really got underway in the 1980s. As interest rates began to come down after the big inflation of the 1970s, it seemed more and more straightforward, more and more attractive to borrow money, whether you were a bank or a household. But it's reached a kind of threshold. We reached a point where we really couldn't credibly borrow anymore. And I say we quite deliberately. It's all very well pointing fingers of blame at, oh, I don't know, Alan Greenspan or Hank Paulson or the Wall Street bankers. But in some measure, we were all caught up in this. I mean, who among us is without sin?
Neil Ferguson, professor of history at Harvard University, also an author most recently of a book called The Ascent of Money. Thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you, Guy.
As we learned yesterday, the official beginning of the recession was a year ago. Seems longer than that somehow. And the effects of a slowing or a stopped economy are hitting more people every day. Over the next couple of months, in a series we're calling Close to Home, we're going to take you to two very different communities to see how that recession is playing out. Yesterday, we visited Wildomar, California. That's a brand new city in the fast-growing suburbs of the Temecula Valley north of San Diego. Today, it's Edina, Minnesota. The recession has been slow to arrive in the wealthy, mostly white-collar suburb of Minneapolis. But Minnesota Public Radio's Annie Baxter reports that even the most well-established cities can only delay a downturn for so long.
You can learn a lot about Edina by standing here at the corner of 50th Street and France Avenue. It's a bustling shopping district where green ceramic tiles crown the roofs of pricey boutiques and Tony restaurants. Downtown Minneapolis and St. Paul are just a few miles away, along with 20 Fortune 500 companies. Many Edina residents work for or even run those companies. And if you want to know how the residents of this affluent suburb are faring in a weak economy, just follow the red brick sidewalk into R.F. Muller Jewelry Store.
I'm treating myself to some jewelry, some bling.
That's Angela. She preferred not to give her last name. And she's buying herself a birthday present. A $2,000 one.
And was this something that you were kind of saving up for?
Oh, no. Spontaneous.
Her friend turns to me and shrugs.
We haven't seen the recession.
The shrinking economy is still an abstraction in much of Edina, which has the wealthiest zip code in the Twin Cities metro area. Folks tend to move to Edina once they're pretty stable financially, and they mostly stay a long time. One city official says that's probably why foreclosure rates have stayed low, while rates in neighboring towns have skyrocketed. Edina may have missed the collapse of the housing market, but it's priming for part two of the downturn, starring wage and job cuts and plummeting stock portfolios. And this time, fewer people will be spared. At Our Lady of Grace Catholic Church, Pastor Bob Schwartz sees Edina's more vulnerable residents. His church is one of the biggest congregations in town.
The assumption that everybody has abundance is not true. There's certainly people who don't in terms of housing or job, but there's certainly senior citizens who are on very limited income here and are really struggling at this point.
Even the high-priced executives are running into trouble. Melissa Miller is the liturgical director at Our Lady of Grace. She knows something about that trouble.
My husband is a financial executive, and he'd been unemployed for several months, and after a job search that was fairly exhaustive, he was able to find another comparable position in New York City.
In the meantime, Miller says her family cut back on expenses and canceled their vacation. They also burned through thousands of dollars in savings. Now, she's stuck trying to sell their $725,000 four-bedroom house while her husband pays New York rents for a studio apartment. A version of Miller's story is repeating itself all over town.
My best friend's been unemployed for 18 months. Last night I spoke to a parishioner who's self-employed, and he said he's got one gig, one surefire gig for the foreseeable future. Another parishioner told me that he'd been unemployed since July. So, yeah, I'm hearing a lot of this.
Still, construction continues on apartments, condos, and retail projects around town. And Edina residents are out and about, if not buying things at local boutiques, then at least window shopping. At R.F. Muller, the jewelry store, sales are flat so far this year. But manager Phil Korst has his own strategy for beating the economy.
Our motto is, or mantra, if you will, is really we're not participating in any slowdown, any recession or anything. We chose not to participate, and we mean it.
But even though the recession has been late in coming, it's gradually taking up residence here. And like it or not, Edina is now participating in the slowdown. In Edina, Minnesota, I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing nearly $8 billion in municipal bond assets. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, the Government Accountability Office has taken its first hard look at the TARP. That is the Treasury Department's $700 billion chunk of the financial bailout. You're probably not going to be too terribly surprised to hear this, but the GAO says Treasury doesn't have a good way to keep track of how the money is being spent, or more accurately, how banks are spending the $150 billion they've gotten so far. You'll be hearing more about this from Congress at a later date, I'm sure, but the GAO specifically cites a lack of accounting controls on banks using bailout money for executive pay and for dividends to their shareholders. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 270 points, 3.3%. The NASDAQ added 51 points, 3.7%. The S&P 500 packed on 32 points. That is just shy of 4%. Thanks to Jennifer Collins and Renita Jablonski on our morning report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by John Buckley, and it is the place you can go early tomorrow morning for the latest on the fallout from the financial crisis. Next time on this program, big cutbacks on little perks.
Well, I've decreased the number of facials. I got rid of my trainer a couple months ago, which I'm glad I did. Decreased spa visits.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.